He did it again. He always does that to me at the Feast of Tabernacles. Sings some beautiful number and gets me all choked up, and then I get up here and try to find my voice. And then I do it back to him in the sermon. He said at the Feast of Tabernacles, at least I did at the feast. I'm sorry, we have some very sad news to announce today. I want to make sure those of you on the tape program who heard about Mr. Bill Moore's condition understood that he did die during the Feast of Tabernacles. And as a matter of fact, by the time we were going to send a card, a get-well card, and we were collecting signatures at the festival site, Mr. Charles Gross brought that to my attention, my wife and I, and the very night, I think, that we were to sign the card, he died. I believe that it was a cancerous situation involving the liver, that it became about double its normal size and simply couldn't sustain its function. He was very heavily anesthetized, and I believe that he felt nothing. He simply went to sleep. So from one standpoint, he was not suffering or in pain, but you can imagine how Mrs. Moore feels at this moment. And we've already sent her, of course, some cards and expressed ourselves to her personally. And I'm sure that many of the rest of you who knew the Moores will want to do the same thing. Is tonight Halloween? Then why are they having a Halloween party at Emerald Bay? Anyway, they're having a Halloween party at Emerald Bay, and they urged me to come. A lot of those people out there watch the television program, and one of the most recent television programs was about Halloween. See, this must be the 29th or so, isn't it? Is it Sunday night? This 28th, so it's Monday night. I don't know which night of the week Halloween is, but it's sometime very soon now. I've lost track of which day it is on the calendar. But on the eve of All Hallows, or Hallowed Evening, in spite of the fact that they misspell it all over our country, literally millions of little urchins are going to take to the street, many of them ferried about by their mothers in station wagons and neighborhood groups, and go trick-or-treating. I've spoken out against this custom, of course, for many decades now. But strangely, when I was a boy, there was no more exciting time than Halloween. It was more exciting for me than even Christmas time, because being brought up in a church family, I had a problem. And my problem was that I was epitomized by Proverbs 23:17. It says, "Let not thine heart envy sinners, but be thou in the fear of the Eternal all the day long." I grew up in a religion and a religious environment that contributed to my envy of people around me, of people in society. Now, this syndrome, the envying of sinners, is something that has deeply affected the lives of our children in the Church of God for literally many, many decades. Unlike the Mormon religion, unlike many other churches who do a marvelous job with their own children, recognizing the most important mission field is our own progeny, the Church of God all but neglected and ignored its children for literally decades. Now, we did have a program, a very limited one, that began up in Big Sandy in the mid-1950s. Mr. Lochner came over there. Guy Carnes, who is seated here today, was a teacher in the Gladewater High School. He came over and became the principal of a fledgling little grade in high school over there where he worked for many, many years. We called it Imperial Schools, and later on we had an Imperial Schools out in Pasadena, and then finally, when the college began in Brickett Wood, we had an Imperial Schools over in Brickett Wood in England. I brought up the complaint to my father on one occasion about the school over in Big Sandy. The people who lived in Big Sandy and worked there paid all of the regular federal and state and county taxes, but they also paid what are called school board taxes. Most of you pay those. I pay those. Out where I live, for the Bullard Independent School District, they tax me. And they also tax us for the junior college that exists here in Tyler, Texas. So I said, here are these people who are paying first tithe, and that is going for the support of all of the work, what is called the general fund. They are paying faithfully their second tithe, and they're urged to give extra second tithe and to tithe on that for the building of the tabernacle in what we called Sudden City, which became known as Booth City, which eventually was turned into college dormitories. And then they are supposed to save every third year a third tithe for the poor. And then there is the building fund, and then there are the letters going out begging people to just go to the bank and borrow money and even loan money to the church, and then a year later, could you turn the loan into a gift and not make us repay it? And they live and work in Big Sandy, and they pay school board taxes, and they also are expected to give money and even pay a little tuition and book fees and so on for Imperial schools. Now, I said, isn't that a little unfair? In the first place, all of the monies that went to the church should be regarded as monies which could defray their child's education. In the second place, it was too narrow in scope, and too few people were able to afford it or take advantage of it. At the point in which my father wanted to borrow $10 million, when we were behind in payroll and having to borrow money even to make payroll from week to week, he wanted to build the auditorium in Pasadena. And I went to him with this situation, and I said, Dad, this was in his suite in Tel Aviv, Israel. We were traveling together, and I laid this on him, as they say. If you want to borrow $10 million to build a building, why build a building in Pasadena that can only accommodate about 1,500 people? When if we went with a national firm, like a Del Webb or someone, and had a modular building, and had a program to do what we have done in Big Sandy, and here in Pasadena on a modest scale, but to do it in Atlanta, and Detroit, and Chicago, and Portland, Oregon, and Denver, Colorado, and Mobile, Alabama, and Miami, Florida, 10 sites, where we can pick the largest increment of our people within a 200-mile radius around some of the big interurban centers, and for $1 million, and we're talking 1970s, maybe 1969, 70, 71 money. That's a lot more than it would be today. For $1 million per, we can build a beautiful little plant with a parking lot and a modular building, and I know we have enough, and we did, enough retired teachers and present teachers and part-time teachers and so on, that we could actually build a local church which would be suitable for the people for all of the annual festivals. It could even become a hub for the Feast of Tabernacles. It could be there for church socials, but it would be like a family life center. It wouldn't look like a church building. We could play badminton and volleyball in it. We could have dances and parties in it. It would have a kitchen. It would have a basketball floor. We could play indoor tennis in it. And we could have classrooms, and we could begin to teach our children, and they could have a social center. And within 1 year, the same amount of money you want to borrow for this one building, this magnificent auditorium, we could have 10 plants all over the United States around which would grow local churches and schools. He bought it right then and there. He said, that's a marvelous idea, Ted. We're going to do it. We excitedly talked about how this could be done. I was going to go home and talk to some architects. Mr. Al Fortuna and I had been in a lot of serious conversations and a lot of other people with an excited idea that this is what we ought to do and delay the building of the auditorium by another 2, 3, 5 years or whatever, because we had a beautiful, fabulous gymnasium in Pasadena in which we were meeting, and we didn't really need an auditorium right then. It was just something my father had wanted to do. Well, we no sooner got back to I forgot to tell you that very next morning, my dad called me into his room. He said, Ted, I've got a great idea. I said, what is that? He said, I know how to do all that you suggested we do and to build the auditorium at the same time. I said, well, how is that? He said, I will write a letter that will get the people so excited that they will send in enough for both projects. And then I matched the shortest verse in the Bible. Ted wept. I did. I literally cried. With my arguments and my disappointment because of what I saw just disappearing, because I just said, Dad, you cannot squeeze blood out of a turnip, and the people simply cannot give more than they're giving, and that plan won't work. Well, of course, the letter went out, it's a matter of record, and it didn't work. Eventually, the college in England was sold, Imperial schools were closed down, and for a number of years, the Big Sandy complex was closed down and creaked in the summer sun. Some of the festival complexes were dismantled and sold. One had its roof collapsed because of snowfall up in the area in the mountains of eastern, it's by the water, Pennsylvania, and in the Pocono. And little by little, the college became a tiny Bible school and went way down from what I had envisioned to become a small university with programs involving grade and high schools dotting the United States. Because at that time we had the membership, we had the numbers, we had, in that sense, the clout to be able to really do something important for our children. Well, at the same time, we came up with the idea of SEP, Summer Educational Program, which was a fantastic success and still is. And eventually that was changed to YOU, Youth Opportunities United, which was merely an acronym that we thought up with a kind of a shield to go with it. And we began the program up at Big Sandy because it was the one facility that could house that type of thing best in about 1960. And by the next year or two, we were up in Orr, Minnesota, and developed a plant that eventually was worth about $3 million and featured a gymnasium and a lot of the facilities and equipment to go with this type of exercise where our youth are concerned. This year at the Feast of Tabernacles, we had a marvelous increase, apparently close to 20%, and approximately some 400 people attended with us at the Feast of Tabernacles. That's almost but not quite double the number who were out in Kings Beach for the very first time. So hopefully our continual mention of the festivals, the very good literature and the articles that we have on the subject, the articles that occurred in the international news, constant teaching from the pulpit, and constant pressure, I think, if that's perhaps an impolite word, at least encouragement from pulpits here and there and from the ministry, caused an awful lot of people to show up at the feast. Did any of you notice a little subtle change at the feast this year? I certainly did. There were a lot more young people than I've noticed in previous years. And 8 or 10 years ago, we were kind of an older church. There were not that many young people around. But this year, there were lots of young people. Early teens, middle teens, late teens, and lots of little kids. My wife and I were asked in just as we were leaving over in Hilton Head Island. And all the little children wanted to sing a song for us. And they must have had 50 or 60 of them in there, all the way from 1.5 or 2 on up to about 6 or 7. And, of course, that moves you to tears because they're all there and they've rehearsed this song and they're singing and some of them are doing this. And you know the way little bitty kids are. They're so embarrassed. And I want to take a picture of every one of them. But they were just really as cute as they could be. Well, we had a lot of festival activities. And that's wonderful as far as it goes. And then some of the kids came up with an idea. Couldn't we have our own publication? So we're going to do the best we can to get going as a part of the international news. Or if it needs to be separate, so be it. A publication for the youngsters in the Church of God International. And, of course, you know that we have been trying to arrange a facility, that we've been trying to purchase some property, that we hope and pray that eventually we will be able to have a national program, including contests involving poetry or art or cheerleading contests, basketball, sports contests, things in which our youngsters can become involved and can have a life other than being dragged off to Sabbath services, sitting there when you're 8 or 10 or 11 or 13, and hearing a sermon that is so far over your head, you really don't know what in the world the old boy up there is talking about. I remember so well, because youngsters at that age are not interested in theology, per se. They're just other things that they're interested in at that time. And we recognize that, so I think we need to do something about it. I want to sort of battle down a syndrome. It was one that I grew up with. It's not true. It's part of Satan's lie that is, I think, expressed in this 17th verse of Proverbs 23. Let not your heart envy sinners, but be you in the fear of the eternal all the day long. What is there that is so negative about our religion that so many youngsters turn away from it? And what is there about the child-rearing practices or the family habits of so many people? But I have seen marriages destroyed, and I mean youngsters growing up in the church. Let me clarify that. I've seen many, many cases, not just a few, but many, where what we thought were happy marriages have been destroyed, and one or the other member, or both, have finally just thrown off all the constraint because of this syndrome, the envy of sinners, the Lot's wife syndrome of looking back with a yearning, longing desire to be back there in Sodom, the idea, I'm missing everything. The world is passing me by. I'm growing older. I'm having babies. I'm sweeping floors. I'm here mending clothes and cooking food and you know, washing the linoleum in the kitchen floor. And I want to swing. I want to have fun. I want to be like it is on the soap operas. And I want to be like I see on TV and like I see when I go to the movies. I mean, there are things out there to be sampled and enjoyed. I've seen marriages just blow up when you wouldn't think there was any really discernible reason for them to blow up, except the kind of frustration that is a part of Satan's lies that causes kids who were unfortunately repressed by their parents and who were given the idea that the truth of God and the church of God, the religion of God, the Ten Commandments and the Word of God in the Bible is a system of don't, no, negative, stop it, don't do it, no fun. It's dull, it's uninteresting, it is kind of making you feel like you're in jail. You can't have any fun. See, when I was a kid, my mom said, Halloween is pagan. But my little mind says, yeah, but it's fun. What's pagan mean? A bar of soap in my hand, an old naughty Mrs. Green over there, I didn't like her. I mean, that was fun, boy, going out and getting on those windows, you know, and writing all sorts of things on Mrs. Green's window. Now, I could relate to that. That was fun. So I wanted desperately to be like the world and to be exactly the way the kids were in my class. I grew up dreading the Sabbath. I grew up dreading the annual holy days. I dreaded walking down the hallway with my little slip to hand it to the principal's office. Would you please excuse Teddy because our church is observing a holy day? Because my dad had no time for me. My father and I were a generation apart. He was 38 when I was born. And by the time I'm 10, he's 48. And when I'm 16, you know, he's 54 or so. So there was just no connection at all. I mean, hunting, fishing, camping, being a pal with, being part with my father was just not there. It was like I was a grandson more than a son. That's perhaps not an excuse, but I don't think that my parents did the very best job that's ever been done in child rearing, and I think they would be the first to tell you if they were here today. My father especially probably thinks he did a very poor job with me in so many ways, but I'm saying that facetiously, kind of tongue-in-cheek. But by and large, we didn't have that good of a relationship in the home. And so I grew up as a young person resenting God's truth, resenting the Sabbath, resenting the holy days. And believe me, there were no kids' programs at Belknap Spring, but it's just fortunate that it was a resort high in the mountains that had an outdoor swimming pool that was heated by thermal waters coming right from beneath the lava in the ground, and it also had a swinging bridge over a river. And I loved to fish, and I loved to be out of doors, and there were the mountains there for me to climb. And though I could never hunt, I could go up and track deer, and I could go and catch beautiful trout. And I once caught a Dolly Varden 22 inches long. Dolly Varden is the same thing as an Arctic char, and they do exist in Oregon waters, or did then, in the 1930s and 40s. And so there were things that I could do to entertain myself. But the first thing I wanted to do was to get away from and outside of that religion. It deprived me from sports. It deprived me of taking part in things in school. So I went to the First Christian Church because they had an inner city league, and I actually got me a Letterman sweater, not from my high school, but from a church playing city basketball. I wanted so badly to wear a Letterman sweater. Anybody here ever want that? When you were in school, the Letterman walking down the hallway, age 16, the great big E. And he even carried a paddle. They had the Letterman's Club, and they were actually the monitors of the hallways. And a kid got in trouble, he hit somebody or dumped books, like they like come up behind you and take two fingers and hit the back of your books, and they just hit the floor. And if you got caught doing that, you just bent over right then and took a few licks. And you were really He-Man macho to be a member of the Letterman squad. I wanted to be one of those. They were called the Axemen in Eugene because it was a lumbering country. So what I'm saying is that I understand. That doesn't cure the problem, just because I understand and because I grew up that way and that I was envious of people around me and wanted to be like them. It says in Proverbs 24 and verse 1, "Be not thou envious against evil men, neither desire to be with them, for their heart studies destruction and their lips talk of mischief." I don't know if you've experienced that powerful pull to be like people around you, but primarily religion says no. If you look at the religions of the world, even the Catholic religion, you look at Stoicism, asceticism, self-denial, women who must not marry but dress in black, wear hoods, and live in convents, men who allegedly must not marry but be pure, and never have a woman but be celibate. So here are religions that, what do they do? They deny the very juices that flow in human veins. They deny the most powerful urges that any kid ever feels when they become 13 or 14. They act like those things don't exist, and like that is evil and sin and wicked, but the most holy state is to not ever do that kind of thing. You don't enjoy sex. You don't even have a sex drive. You just go around. Everything's cosmetic. You know what I'm saying? You're wearing a dress, and you're a man. You're wearing a dress, but you're a man. Everything's cosmetic. It's just there for decoration. You're holy. And religions are that way. And unfortunately, we were a little too much that way. And a lot of our regulations were don't. I remember a case up at Orr, Minnesota. Every time we found something happening that was sin, it seemed that the Pharisees among us always felt that somehow a little bit of the dirt got onto their garments, and they felt responsible. So if youngsters at SEP, quote, end quote, got in trouble, it was the responsibility of the leadership, and they were accountable to the parent. And so if kids went to the Feast of Tabernacles and went and stayed out too late and did something they shouldn't do, and I won't elaborate, or if they went to SEP up at Orr and got off by themselves and did something they shouldn't do, and I won't elaborate, it was the responsibility of the leadership. Well, one day, one of the counselors walked in and found a boy and a girl who'd been seeing each other on and off, standing there talking to each other right in the dining room. I'm going to put a stop to this. Figured out how to do it. Made a new rule. The girls trooped in there at 11 o'clock, and they sat down to lunch, and the girls stood up and marched out and disappeared to the girls' point, and the boys came marching in at 12 o'clock, and they sat down and had lunch. We'll just keep them apart. See, what the world does is always try to perfect the chastity belt, design a new chastity belt, and make this one work. So again, it was preventive legislation. We're going to make a rule, and we're going to prevent this kind of thing. Marriages by the score were contracted where the man and the woman never got to know one another. Why? Because of the fear that if they were ever to kiss, it might feel good, and they might want to do it again and kiss even longer than that first time. Now, there was a double standard, but basically the regulations were, and I will quote them from my memory, students may not date pursuant to marriage until the second semester of their senior year, end quote. Now, you think that through. Here are young men and women with all the juices flowing who are together in classes, beach parties, and that's when they wear bathing suits, snowline parties, trips to the feast on the buses, singing and so on in the chorale, in the band, on the athletic field, in and out of classroom and so on, 3.5 years. Now, 3.5 years into college, it was all right to date pursuant to marriage. Now, we always had a dance right there at midterm in the college, and at that dance it became tradition, but that's when all the engagements were announced. Now, how can that be? When presumably they had never kissed. Yet it was at the beginning of the second semester that dozens of marriages were contracted. Now it was all right to kiss the girl. Wasn't that marvelous? So people looked in amazement later on when they saw marriages blowing up, wives running off somewhere with some strange man, husbands running off with some strange woman, marriages just dissolving because people didn't have the right foundation under them in the first place. I hope we can avoid some of those mistakes as we mature and develop, because you see, we are doing that now. Our numbers are swelling rather dramatically. We are growing. We're growing in numbers. I hope we're growing in maturity and wisdom. Eventually, God will provide physical facilities because those things will follow. The most important thing is the quality of the character that is developed and the quality of the message that goes out and the way we perform our job, television and radio, if and when we're back on radio, and in the printed literature we send out and through the local churches in our evangelistic campaigns and our own personal evangelistic efforts and examples, and the way we perform as husbands and wives, as fathers and mothers, as family members, and as brethren in God's church. It's been said the best things in life are free. Now let me just explain something to blow up that concept a lot of people have had in the past, and I'm going to turn to the book of Deuteronomy and begin in chapter 5 and verse 29 and a few select verses here to what God really has in store for us when we observe His laws. Now, the word God's laws, the expression God's laws, is not a very popular expression to an 8-year-old or a 10-year-old or a 15 or 16-year-old. How well I remember. But bear with me, and I think maybe we'll come to have a little better meaning. Verse 29 of Deuteronomy 5, "Oh, that there were such an heart in them, that they would fear me and keep all my commandments always, that it might be well with them and with their kids, their children, forever." Now, why does it include the children, that it's going to be good for the kids if the family observes God's laws? Well, that'll come clear, too, as we go along. Verse 33, "You shall walk in all the ways which the Eternal your God has commanded you, that you may live, and that it may be well with you, and that you may prolong your days in the land which you shall possess, for their good." A little later on it says in verse 5, "You shall love the Eternal your God with all your heart." This is the next chapter 6, verse 5. "With all your soul and with all your mind, and these words which I command you this day shall be in your heart. And you shall teach them diligently unto your children, and shall talk of them when you sit in your house, and when you walk by the way, and when you lie down, and when you rise up. And you shall bind them for a sign upon your hand," that is figurative metaphor, "and they shall be as frontlets," because then they wore the kind of a chain like jewel with a little pendant on the forehead, "between your eyes. And you shall write them upon the posts of your house and on your gates." And then it said, "When you get into the land which you swore to give Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and great and goodly cities which you didn't build, and houses full of all good things which you didn't fill, and wells dug which you didn't dig, and vineyards and olive trees, and you didn't plant them. And when you have eaten and you are full, then beware lest you forget the Eternal who brought you out of Egypt," and so on. In chapter 7, it says in verse 11, "You shall therefore keep the commandments and the statutes and the judgments which I command you this day to do them. Wherefore it shall come to pass, if you will hearken to all these judgments and keep and do them, that the Eternal your God shall keep unto thee the covenant and the mercy which he swore to your fathers, and he will love you and bless you and multiply you and bless the fruit of your womb and the crops that you grow out of your soil, your corn, wine, and oil, the increase of your cattle, the flocks of your sheep, in the land which he swore unto the fathers to give you. You shall be blessed above all people. There shall not be a male or female barren among you or among your cattle. And the Eternal will take away from you all sickness and will put none of the evil diseases of Egypt, which you know, upon you, but will lay them upon all those that hate you." Now, what is wrong with that? It is really everything that every human being could ever want. And that has to do with all the fun and all the excitement, because you don't multiply and you don't have children unless you, as they say, quote, fall in love and get married and live with a delightful companion of the opposite sex in marriage the way God intends and just have a delightful married life. I'm going to list the best things in life in order that I think they should occur. And I'm going to say that, first of all, the most precious thing I can imagine is to have a sound, healthy mind. Even above having disfiguring problems like missing a limb, being a poor paraplegic who is confined to a wheelchair. And the reason I say that is because the most priceless possession you have is your mind. That's where the human spirit resides. That's where the potential of becoming a member of God's family resides. It doesn't reside in your elbow or your kneecap or your ankle or your hands, but in your mind. When you have something wrong in the upper story, I know people who've experimented with drugs. And just exactly like you have a very fabulous computer, and you would take a little 22 bullet and shoot it right through the works in there somewhere and destroy some circuitry or whatever, it's never going to function correctly. You might be able to turn it on. I don't know. I don't know that much about computers, even though I have one. But what I'm saying is that it's possible, with the abuse of some of these so-called controlled substances, to literally burn out brain cells. And I've seen this happen in lives where nothing but wretchedness, I mean financial debacles and heartache, grieving parents, kids that are unable to put it together, can't hold a job, can't make a wise decision, cannot put down roots, will just do crazy things, just pull up, just sell something, move a couple, three, four states away, anything that is kind of harebrained. Why? Because it was fun at a party one night. Go ahead, a sugar cube, a little LSD. Try it. It's fun. Just half a lewd, man. Half a lewd. You know what that language Bronson does? He's been in the school. Quaaludes. And, hey, man, I got to have half a lewd. But the Reds and the Bennies are all passe now. It's Coke. Today, it's one of the cheapest and easily obtainable drugs in the United States, making Colombian drug lords filthy billionaires, multi-billionaire rich, while millions of kids, themselves the victims of broken homes and non-existent homes and families, and I think sometimes, too, kids who have run away from strict parents and who have run away to have the good life that they think they're going to find on the streets of the big cities in our country, and that millions of them don't find, but find something so wretched it's impossible to describe instead. Male and female prostitution is the common means of survival. There are famous streets in Los Angeles and big articles that I've read when I go out there to visit Dave and Molly, and we'll look at the Los Angeles Times, and of course, remember, I lived there for about 25 some odd years. And there are streets in the Hollywood and the Beverly Hills area where old pot-bellied businessmen cruise around at night, and there are boys walking along there. And they're 13, 14, and 15. Somewhere back in Missouri, Kansas, Arkansas, or Texas, or somewhere else in California, there's a grieving parent. There's a mother that is just beside herself, not knowing where her boy is. Remember the old song done by the Maddox Brothers and Rose years and years ago? He was some mother's darling, some mother's son. Once he was strong and once he was young, something about that. But now they left him to die like a tramp on the streets. But it was something about they left him to die like a tramp on the streets. But the words were he was some mother's darling, some mother's son. And that comes back to my mind. So true. You can go to those big cities and you can go to those districts and you can see thousands of youngsters who recoiled from a situation like I describe and who simply took off because they had the same syndrome that Satan the devil wants to have all of the people in God's church accept. Envy of what is out there. Desire to sample it all. The drugs, the fast life, the racy cars, the scene that they show with all the kids with their Dr. Peppers in their hands on the beach. I mean, everything, even from advertising that says experience, feel, enjoy. They got a stupid shower head ad that is a big lie. It was on television twice this morning on CNN. And they got somebody singing, ooh, feels so good. You know exactly what they're talking about. They make it sound like they're in the throes of you know what. And it's just somebody, it's showing a foot and a leg and a knee and part of a shoulder and a back. And they're under this idiot shower head that goes psh, 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 instead of shh. My wife and I bought one once. We put it on our bathroom thing. It doesn't work. It hurts. When it gets into that stinging part, you don't want it on you. It hurts your back. I can't stand it. I took it off, put the old one back on. That's what we use all the time. But that ad is selling sex. They're trying to make taking a shower into a sensual experience. I blame advertising right along with entertainment as the constant din of what is out there, what you ought to avail yourself of, what you ought to sample, and what you ought to enjoy. Now, you know, when you're my age, you're not that impressionable. I mean, you can't be impressed with that as much as you can. But, man, when you're 13 to 16 to 17, that's heavy stuff. I remember real well. That is heavy stuff. And it's a constant din. It's saying, here I am. Sample me. Come out here. Partake. Be a part of this. Get some of it. How do you have a sound, healthy mind? Whatever goes in there is going to stay. You are what you think. You are what you ingest mentally. Now, I know that people missing limbs can become brilliant authors. They can be scientists. They can be poets. They can be artists. They can be computer designers or operators or systems programmers. They can be anything they want to be, as the ad for the Army says. Be anything you want to be. Join the Army. Well, that's nonsense, and everybody ought to know it. Because the last thing you're going to be is, just a grunt. You're going to do exactly what they tell you to do, and you're not going to get the kind of education you would get, even though education in colleges is not what it's cracked up to be and costs about five times what it should. The second thing that I would say is a sound, healthy body. You can't buy it. You can't buy a sound, healthy mind. But you can sure protect the mind you have and keep it from being damaged by not ingesting harmful substances that affect your mind. And remember that there are psychosomatic relations between the body and the mind, and the mind really is where your health resides when you really get right down to it. Because you can make yourself sick just by thinking the wrong thoughts, and that's been proven. All the way up to 50% of certain diagnosed diseases have been proven to be psychosomatic, all the way to ninth-month pseudo-pregnancies with swelling out to here, documented in medical books. It's true. People can think they're pregnant and start to swell. So the point I'm making is that unless your mind is healthy, your body probably won't be either. Because even diseases like the one that killed Karen Carpenter was in her mind. She wasn't fat. She was a real slim, almost skinny, beautiful young girl with a fabulous voice. And somebody said an unkind thing to her. I think it was her own mother on one occasion. Made her feel that she was fat. And her mind just kind of snapped. So she'd look in the mirror. She didn't see a skinny girl like we saw. She saw one that was getting fat. And she would eat and then vomit, and eat and vomit, and eat and vomit, and it killed her. And she died. So my point is made. To have a healthy body, there is nothing like the feeling of participating in sports events and being very, very good at it. I mean, throw a 60-yard pass and score. If you're a defensive lineman, sack the quarterback. If you're a basketball star, try to average 37 points a game with 11 assists and be a good man on defense and be a point guard in the NBA. There's nothing that is more thrilling than watching a guy like Michael Jordan play basketball. And these guys will come on in these drug programs. Some of them, the other way. But, who was a young guy, had his whole life in front of him, absolutely the top draft pick, college star, was one of the up-and-coming, Bias, yeah, Lynn Bias. I'd forgotten that, but I knew that this kid, one time in his life, with some other people around him, and what was he doing? He was celebrating the fact that he had made it, and he had never used drugs. And once he did it, and it killed him. Now, there is nothing I'm saying when I talk to kids, or talk to families that have kids, or a church that has a lot of kids, about wanting to excel in basketball, or tennis, or track, or canoeing, or anything you want to talk about that is wrong or bad or out of step with any school in the United States or any carnal-minded pursuit in the world. Sure, you want to be the best you can be. And so does God want you to be the best you can be. And the point is that His laws are mostly yes. They are mostly how-to. They are mostly there to protect you from evil things that would ruin your mind and wreck your body and take away from you a brilliant mind and a good physical body with the strength that you want and reduce you to a half-baked, as they say, half-functioning quart short, or as they say, one oar in the water, twisted off, not quite all there, mental wreck instead of the kind of a person you ought to be. The church obeys dietary laws. I drove past a clinic in a little Texas town the other day. The parking lot was absolutely jammed. There were three people coming out, and every one of them looked like they were about to die. There was a hugely overweight woman with swollen ankles out to here. A little bitty, skinny, gray-haired lady that was doubled over, and another one with one of these walkers. And they were all three helping one another. I'm thinking, I hope none of those ladies falls, because they were moving with such little, painful steps like this and headed toward a car in a parking lot. And I thought, they can't be more than in their early 70s. Then I got to thinking about diet. And my mind just goes that way. I guess I thought, I wonder how many pigs in their entire life those three women represent. Probably a herd that would go completely over the landscape. If you thought of all those mornings when that bacon was frying in there and those eggs swimming in the grease, all those days when they put the chitlins and the little hush puppies with just a bunch of grease and rolling up a dough ball, salt and pepper, put spice in it, and drop it in the fat. And the diet that people eat year after year after year that is proving the damage, you know, and the terrible assault that the human body can take, and that results in terrible disease, crippling disease, painful disease, because people are eating things that they should never eat, that are not good for them. Centuries ago, when God gave His law to Israel, He said they were not to eat the fat. Do you know that it is a revolution in the United States of America that is basically less than 10 years old, when the AMA and all the nutritionists and everybody is finally saying all these thousands of years later, you really shouldn't eat fat. They finally caught up with God, who told them in ancient Israel, don't eat the fat, because all the poisons of animals are stored in the fat. And the fat is going to clog up your arteries, and it's going to kill you. It's very hard to digest for your body to break down the fat, digest with much more difficulty than real good lean meats do. Now they're a little afraid of red meat. That's nonsense. God says you shall eat, and lists all of the cattle. What is He talking about? Why, the greatest example of eating meats in the Bible is lamb. God Himself designated roast lamb for the Passover originally. And the eating of cattle and lamb, and even lists the hartebuck and the roebuck, meaning deer and elk, which is the reddest, leanest meat you can get a hold of. It's nonsense to say red meat causes cancer. It's nonsense. Now, someone who perhaps has a peculiar situation, who doesn't need to eat as much red meat as they do, but you know why they tell people not to eat red meat? Sure you do. Because of all the junk they made the cow eat, or they stuck into the cow with a big needle, all kinds of things that cause double the weight gain, you know, in about half the time. Ask Benny Sharp sometime about chickens. He can tell you that his mom still raises chickens, and one of his brothers does. And they make their living that way. And only a few years back, those chickens grew half as big in twice the time. Now, they grow double the size they did in a matter of weeks, and it's astounding to hear Benny tell about it. Why? Chemicals. They insert pellets in them. They put chemicals in the mash that they feed them. They don't let them exercise. They just sit there in a cage, their old feet all gnarled. A lot of them are on the ground, but there's nothing to peck except each other, so they knock off part of the bill. All those chickens got half of the front bill clipped off, if you go look at them, so they can't peck one another. I won't belabor that issue, except to say that I wish, like everything, that there were some Hebrew Orthodox people in our community who raised and killed and marketed kosher chickens. Because the way they will do it is let the chickens crop. They will let them have green vegetables. They will let them eat the things that chickens normally ought to eat, like grass and green things and insects. And the eggs will have a yolk that will be so deep orange, you won't recognize it because yours are a light, bright yellow, almost the color of a light bulb. And the whites on those eggs would stand up. They won't just spill all over kind of bluish and run all the way off the griddle. And you're scrambling to keep your egg on the griddle. It's running down in the drain about half the time. And every now and then you break an egg and it's got little old kind of red blood-like veins in it. You get, ew, throw that away. Don't eat that. I read an article from these people that they actually kill that chicken by decapitating it, hanging it up, and making sure all the blood is drained from the body. And then the washing that they go through and the preparation of the bird and so on must be impeccable. And I wish I could buy some. I've got a big advertisement from a place out in L.A. that markets chickens that are both raised and killed properly. It would be decent food to eat. But the reason they're saying stay away from red meat, and it's kind of ridiculous, say eat more chicken, and you look at the chicken farms that actually cater to Colonel Sanders and these churches and all the fried chicken places, and what do? They're giving you chemically infested meat from birds that grew in weight gain twice as fast as they used to from chemicals, and then they are putting a batter on it with their own secret recipe, which, if you knew the truth, probably has a lot more chemicals in it and preservatives and things you shouldn't be eating, and then it is dripping with grease when you eat it. Pick up one piece and look at your fingers. All right, enough of that. I could talk about that for hours. I won't do that anymore. The church recognizes sound dietary laws, eating clean foods in right balance. I'd like to ask anyone, and I would like to ask myself when I was 13 and resented it, what in the world is wrong with good food in proper amounts and regular exercise? Nothing. Something religious about that? Absolutely not, but most people don't get it. Now, of course, even the doctors agree with me, the nutritionists, and I'm on solid footing now with Methodists, Baptists, and Catholics alike. They all agree that we ought to eat right and have regular exercise. But many people in the church don't emphasize that. If we as parents only emphasize the doctrinal things, going to Sabbath and going to the feast, and we never really discuss all of the other aspects of the truth of God that has to do with our physical well-being among our children, they'll never translate. You know, when it said, you talk about these, how do you talk about, thou shalt have no other gods before thee, when you are sitting in your house, and when you walk by the way, and when you lie down, and when you rise up? You can't. You'd exhaust the subject in one evening. But because this included all of the laws which had to do with cattle, with landmarks, with inheritances, with marriage, with how to treat servants, with children, and the entire law, and the way it was applied in every conceivable little human aspect, there was plenty to talk about. Now, I can ramble on forever, and I'd probably bore you half to death, and I can see I am some of you anyway, talking about chickens. But I'm really talking about God's law. I'm really talking about a principle of God that is being violated by people whose God is a fast buck instead of your health and mine. See? So it's a principle of God. And if parents don't translate these things into their discussion at home, it's no wonder a lot of kids get the idea that, hey, this religion is not for me because it doesn't apply. It's not something I can relate to. It's not something that I want a part of. It's not fun for me. Well, if they only knew. Third, behind healthy mind, healthy body, I guess I'd have to say, I got to put food, clothing, and shelter, and therefore say, good job or successful business to be successful. I don't know if there's a kid out there, whether he's 12 or 18, who thinks the world owes him a living, or he's going to stumble along the corner one day and find a Brinks truck careening around a corner and dump a bag of a million at his feet. I imagine there are some, because the states have got lotteries, and you know who plays them? The people who can afford it the least, all the poor. Because that idea, well, the odds are only 37.3 million to one. Oh, man, let me go buy a ticket. That'd be like a roulette wheel almost as big as the state of Texas, a little thing the size of a pea. And you get the wheel going real fast and throw that little grain out there and hope it lands in only one little number about that big. And by the millions, they line up and do it. So you can't stop that. People are going to gamble. But God's laws, God's principles will make you successful in business, and if you don't have a healthy mind and a healthy body, you won't be successful anyway. And there's a great deal in this that says so, by the way. I'm going to go to Deuteronomy 7 and verse 7. The Eternal did not set His love upon you, nor choose you, because you were more in number than any people, for you were the fewest of all people. But because God loved you, because He would keep the oath which He had sworn to your fathers, as the Eternal brought you out with a mighty hand and redeemed you, out of the house of bondmen, from the hand of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. Now therefore, know that the Eternal thy God, He is God, the faithful God, which keeps covenant and mercy with them that love Him and keep His commandments to 1,000 generations, and repays them that hate Him to their face, to destroy them. He will not be slack to repay him that hateth Him. He will repay him to his face. And so He says, you shall therefore keep these commandments. It shall come to pass, if you hearken to them, and so on, that the Eternal your God will keep the covenant and mercy which He swore to your fathers, and He will love you and bless you and multiply you. That's talking about financial success. It's talking about beautiful homes. It's talking about health and long life. It's talking about children and marriages. He will bless the fruit of your womb. My wife and I had experienced in our early marriage a total of 6 pregnancies, 3 children born, 2 of whom were born profoundly deaf. I knew dozens of families in the church who were unable to have children, many in the ministry, many, not just a few. The statistics, if you look at it, I think I heard it not too long ago that it was something like 20 to 30% of the American married public unable to have children. Now, I'd rather have been unable in one sense, but looking back, you never say that because hindsight's beautiful and you don't have those choices. And we wouldn't take the world for either of our two sons who were born deaf. I'm talking very candidly and very plainly to tell you I live in a real world and I know exactly what I am talking about. There is no known cause for deafness, but it's listed in the book of Deuteronomy. Deafness, blindness, the diseases of Egypt and so on, that would be laid upon people because we are an end-time generation of inferior creatures who have experienced thousands of years of degeneration. We're not bigger, taller, stronger, and better than our ancestors were. In every way, we are inferior to the races of people who have gone before, with the exception of that period of time known as the Dark and the Middle Ages, when men became very small because of lack of diet, and when infant mortality was even higher than it is today, and where life expectancy was very, very short. And a lot of our growth is artificial, as I mentioned. He will bless the fruit of your womb, the fruit of your land, your corn and your wine and your oil, the increase of your kind, the flocks of your sheep, and the land which ye swear to your fathers to give you. You shall be blessed above all people. There shall not be a male or female barren among you or among your cattle. And God will take away all of these evil diseases. How many of us, can I see our hands? Because I'll raise mine every time I ask. How many of you had the measles? How many had the measles? 100%? Anybody here never had the measles? Never had them. Wow! Don't ever get around somebody with measles. How many of you had the mumps? I had the mumps. How many of you had chicken pox? I had the chicken pox. I was born with yellow jaundice. How many had yellow jaundice? Yeah, a bunch of us. You see what I'm saying? I could go on. How many colds do you have per year? 2 to 3. How many of you ever had the flu? Oh, a couple dozen times. How many of you ever been in the hospital for an operation? I have. Repair surgery on my elbow. And on it goes. Now, if you just look at this, and you look at it practically, and you say, wow, never sick a day of your life? A kid that is born healthy and never even gets a cold? That's what God promises. But there is cause and effect. There is a reason why a child would grow up that way. And it is not found in the prepackaged long shelf life cereals and junk that they advertise, nor in the baby foods that they strain and take practically every bit of nutrition out of. Hopefully there's a little bit in Gerber's that is good, but it's convenient. You open the cap and spoon it directly into the baby's mouth. You do not have to cook vegetables under low heat that are appropriately, organically grown, clean them, cook them, take them and put them through a ricer, and reduce them into a pulp in some kind of a food blender, and then make the baby food yourself. It's far more convenient to buy it off the shelf with all the preservatives and anything else that's in there. So we do it. He will take away from you all sickness and put none of the evil diseases of Egypt, which you know, upon you, but will lay them upon all that hate you. In the 8th chapter of Deuteronomy, he says again to listen, because they were going over Jordan and they were going to meet this great and tall people, the children of the Anakims. And he said in verse 6, understand therefore that the Eternal your God gives you not this good land to possess it for your righteousness, because you're a stiff-necked people. Remember and forget not how you provoked the Eternal your God to wrath in the wilderness. In Horeb you provoked him, and so on. And then he goes on to say how when Moses was going to receive the mount, he fell down, abode there 40 days, did neither drink bread nor eat water. And finally, he came down, and God was going to destroy the Israelites because of their hard-heartedness. And Moses had to pray. In verse 14, you'll see where God proposed he was going to actually destroy them all and make of Moses a mightier nation. And he fell down, as it was, before the Eternal at the first, and began to fast and pray and say, blot out my life from your book, but don't do this because of what the heathen would say. Here were a people who were bitten with that same syndrome when they had a visible demonstration of the power of God in a daily sense. They could look at that tabernacle and see that huge black cloud with flames boiling out of it like a refinery on fire every single day. And every night they could see those billowing flames. they had heard the earthquake. They'd heard a rumble that wasn't really the voice of God, but probably the voice of an archangel, because Christ said you've neither seen his face nor heard his voice at any time. But they'd seen visible manifestations, and they fled from the mountain and said, "Don't let God talk with us, lest we perish. Let Moses speak with us." Yet here were people who had the same syndrome as did Lot's wife, and the same syndrome I grew up with, even with the visible presence of God. Not now a lot of old guys talking out of a pulpit and putting you to sleep, talking about the Ten Commandments and religion and God's laws and God's government and being born again and on, but something you could see and you could hear. It was right there in front of you. And in spite of that, they wanted to go back into Egypt and said, "We remember the leeks and the garlic, and we want to get back and have..." What else did they remember about Egypt? Well, the women didn't wear many clothes. And there was a lot of public display of sexuality and sensuality. And even portrayed on their walls and murals were pictures of things that were rather libidinous, to say the least. And everything that was tantalizing to the appetite, because it said very clearly in God's prophecies, the Egyptians who are, quote, great of flesh, end quote. Everything was carnal. Everything was sensuous. It was feel this way, exactly as our society is today. And so these people wanted to go back to Egypt. Yet they had a visible manifestation of the power of God. The fourth point I've listed is to have a happy marriage. We write our articles. We preach our sermons. Mr. Dart gave a sermon recently that we advertised and we're sending out, I believe, on how to prevent divorce. Over in Dallas-Fort Worth. I think we advertised that, or I was intending to, in a letter. Now, I remember writing a full booklet way back years ago about how to have an appropriate date. I would redo that booklet a little bit, but it wasn't far off. It was pretty much right down the line the way it should have been, I think. My wife and I used to get very irked at some of those in official positions in the church because of the way they tried to arrange dating. And because it was a double standard between what my father would tell people and my mother and what the ministry would tell people. My father once asked a young man in England who was talking about very seriously wanting to marry, and I think Mr. Dart knows this story better than I because I don't remember who the participants were, just vaguely and basically the story. He was shocked. He says, "You mean you've never even kissed the girl?" I don't know if he was a sophomore or a senior. I assume he's a senior. He said, "Absolutely not. Why, that would have been against the rules." My dad said, "Young man, I want you to take that girl the next time you see her and go upstairs to a classroom and lock the door and kiss her." Now, I could come up with a bunch of names of ministers, and I could ask you, can you imagine in your wildest dreams minister so-and-so ever saying something like that? You can't. But my dad did. I remember others who would come to me. I remember one young man who was a very nice-looking young man, very athletic. His dad worked for me in the radio studio, and he was in love with and wanted to marry a very beautiful... No, I'm sorry, it was the dad of the girl that worked for me in the radio studio, and they wanted to get married. Well, one of our fellows who ended up in the federal penitentiary, he was a minister. One of my right-hand men, my wife could never stand him, and I finally had to agree with her. I finally saw through what a true jackass of a human being this man was, and all that that term may imply. He became a con man. He left the ministry. He was bilking people out of money, and he is right now in the Carpinteria Men's Prison in California serving a prison sentence. Okay, that's the man I'm talking about. Now, this man, who was so righteous, went to this young couple and told them that she was far smarter than the man, and because their IQs were not matched, that they should knock it off, that they should not date, they should just put it on the shelf. And they were in love with one another. A couple of beautiful human specimens. I mean, a handsome young man, beautiful young girl. I learned about it through the father. He told me about it, so I called the young boy in. And I kind of blew up. I said, "Well, when this man, this minister, counseled you, did he ask you to go talk to the girl's father?" And he worked on the campus. He wasn't in Poughkeepsie. He wasn't back here in Lenore or somewhere in Springfield, Missouri. He was right there next to my office on the fourth floor of the building. Why, no, he didn't tell me to go counsel with the father. I said, well, what about your parents? I said, what about the parents? Do the parents have anything to do with this? I guess it was shocking to him to think that he would hear a minister say that the parents ought to be involved and that kids ought to talk to their parents about marriage plans, or that they ought to make an adult mature decision on their own without some minister deciding who they're going to pick and choose for them. But I just told him, I said, you date that girl. And I said, you date her whenever and however and as often as you would like. And I asked him to go talk to the gentleman in there. And then I talked to the man myself, and I said, if I were you, Frank, I'll tell you what I'd do. I'd go down and hire me a deep-sea fishing trip, or I'd have a family picnic, or I'd invite him over for dinner, and I'd get to know him in a family sense. I'd get to know that young boy because I think he's a fine young man. Well, I don't know the whole story. Maybe they married and divorced. I hope not, but I don't know. All I know is that it was an example I can just pull out of my rather rich memory of such examples of how to do it all wrong, how to arrange these marriages the wrong way. And there is no way to arrange a marriage anyway. That's something that is for the people who were involved to decide. There isn't any magic formula, but I know that people who are converted and people who bring God into their marriage and who will get down on their knees together and pray and who can say, I'm sorry, and who can pray and confess their own faults and sins first in the hearing of their mate and then turn to each other in love, have a marvelous opportunity to have a happy marriage. Those who will not talk, those who will not communicate, those who look at all the movies and read the books and they think the way to do it, like old Bill Cosby is, I go into the bathroom, slam the door, and I cry first. He has a real funny one on it. Well, unfortunately, we like the stalking through the house, slamming each door as you go kind of a routine instead of talking through the house and opening each door as you go. And so not too many people have that ideal happy marriage, but God's laws will provide it. Fifth, healthy, obedient children. Can't buy it. Money does not provide it, but God's laws and God's way do. I can list a lot of others, and I think one important one that is denied many of us is peace of mind and a full, deep night's sleep. Where you go to sleep weary at the end of a good and productive day, you fall asleep immediately, and you stay asleep, and you don't have nightmares, and you don't hurt, and you're not up pacing the floor at 2 or 3 o'clock looking for a pill to kill your pain, and you can't buy it, and many of us don't have it because of mistakes we made earlier in life that have deprived us of it. What I'd like all of our families to communicate to our kids and to our youngsters is that the way of God is a way that will give them every kick, every wonderful sensation, every bit of excitement, every thrill, every bit of fun that there is to be had in life, which doesn't give you a kickback, which doesn't give you a hangover, which doesn't burn out your brain, doesn't ruin your body, it doesn't destroy your liver, it doesn't destroy or ruin your lungs. It means that you will be able to do things way on up into life by obeying those right principles and laws, that the ones who are out there sampling what you think is fun today will have wrecked their lives, wrecked their chances for any kind of a really wonderful life. And they're doing it with both hands greedily every single day. To me, the Feast of Tabernacles should be Christmas, Easter, Halloween, all rolled up into one for our youngsters. And I have been very delighted to see the way a lot of our adults have pitched in. We've had a lot of people who have volunteered countless hours. We had a lot of women back there who were working with those little children. They've worked with them at all ages. And I am just tickled to death with this Festival of Tabernacles. I thought it was the warmest, fullest, best, most inspiring I've ever seen. I noticed a large increase, not only about a 20% increase in maybe 400 new people, but a large increase in young people, and I noticed a lot of volunteers going a long way out of their way to provide a lot of activities for them. And I think we ought to just even have more so. We ought to have a full day or two where kids are not expected necessarily to come to services, but where events are arranged for them which would be as exhilarating or as useful to them as it would be to be seated in services on that particular day, and recognize that and work with them. We've always used the old cliches, our most priceless resource is our children. Well, they're certainly my most priceless resource, Shirley and I, our kids, our sons. And when you, in a very personal way, have had to come face to face with some of these mistakes of this world, some of the failures, some of the heartache, and things that just break your heart, you're not just, you know, up here theorizing about it. You're talking right from the gut level about things that really matter in life. And if there's any way we can, as we mature as the Church of God International, avoid some of the mistakes of the past and avoid this preventive legislation and reap the rewards that we've been reading about here in Deuteronomy, there is no way that I know of, short of God's laws, to guarantee a healthy, happy, sound mind, healthy body, happy families, healthy children, long life, plenty of time to enjoy it. And that's what God's laws mean to me. Not no, but yes.